Today's show is brought to you by Cody Akins at AkinsPCRepair.com. Hey, welcome to the show, all 11 of you. It is me, Jonathan, and my good buddy James. Hey, good buddy James.
Hello, all.
So we're going to be continuing this thing we've been kind of trying to do over the last couple of weeks called Shut Up and Listen, where we're just leaning into what I feel like is a strength of ours, and that's bitching and waxing nostalgic about music that we liked from years ago, but also exploring some of it, because some of it's really fun to get into. Like today, I decided to do something I'd been looking for an excuse to do this forever. Smells Like Teen Spirit, the riff of the 90s, that you all know it. I don't need to hum it or anything. It was always called a ripoff, even by Kurt Cobain, of More Than a Feeling. He claimed it was More Than a Feeling. He was like, I did it as a joke because I thought people would get it. But then the song took off and I was just like, okay, I'm just playing More Than a Feeling then. Is that what I'm doing? And while it does sound like More Than a Feeling, More Than a Feeling also sounds like another song. And that sounds like another song. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to go on a journey that starts in 1991 and ends in the early 40s.
And it doesn't involve the band Journey.
It does not. No. We
not
do
directly.
Go to Boston. and then wherever the Trogs are from, I think Detroit. And then the Kingsmen. It just keeps going. And I could keep going with it, but at a certain point, I had to stop. You just have to stop at some point. We're going to do some what-if scenarios, which will be fun. For instance, if Japan had never invaded China, John Lennon might still be alive. Because I don't know if you guys know this, but he was killed in Nanking in 1939.
During World War II.
Yeah, before he was even born. What's your what-if scenario, James?
My what-if scenario is when Jeff Beck was still with the Yardbirds, he set up a recording for a song that he and Jimmy Page had been tooling around on. Mm-hmm. And his initial choice for drummer was Keith Moon. And when he asked Keith Moon who they should get on bass, Keith Moon suggested John Entwistle. And that almost happened. And it was during a rather fraught time in the history of The Who.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very possible that if it had gone according to plan, that they could have splintered off and formed a different group.
All right. We'll go
history
over
may
that.
Have been quite a bit different.
We'll go over that in just a few minutes. But let's start here with some music news in the current present day. There's going to be a Spinal Tap 2, a sequel to Spinal Tap, the movie. What did that come out in 1980?
I saw this the other day. My sister, actually.
Oh, 1984 is when Spinal Tap came out. For some reason, I thought it was earlier than that. But yeah, 1984, obviously, you know, the movie, and we could reference it and quote it endlessly. And James can do that a lot better than me. I'm not as good with the quotes and references as him. But it was obviously a big movie, and if you love music, I'm sure you've seen it. What
spawned a genre, essentially.
Yeah. Here, 38 years later, they're planning on doing a sequel, and the sequel is going to be about their manager, who is now dead. His wife says that he had a contract when he died that she has access to now, that if Spinal Tap doesn't play one more show, then they owe her millions of dollars. It seems convoluted. It seems weird, but, you know, I don't know. This is the problem with these movies. Not Spinal Tap movies in general, but I'm just saying movies that are sequels to movies that just are cult classics or are favorites of, you know, maybe more idiosyncratic ones. I mean, and I'm talking about like Anchorman and Zoolander and so many other movies like that where nobody was really clamoring for a sequel. And then they were like, oh, it'd be fun to do it again. And they never work. They just never do. So my initial reaction always was with Anchorman 2. Same thing. Like, oh, this is gonna be great. I love Anchorman. Oh, I can't wait to see those characters again. And you saw Anchorman 2, and then you went, let's just forget this movie ever existed because it was terrible. And I really feel like the same thing is going to happen with This is Spinal Tap 2 as well, because I don't know. James, is there any reason to hope that this movie is going to be good?
Well, so much of it, and I guess you could probably say the same thing about Anchorman, but so much of it is going to be the improv of those guys. And they never lost that.
Yeah, because if you don't know, and James, you alluded to this earlier, and I kind of trampled over you, and I'm sorry about that. It started a whole mockumentary kind of genre. I mean, those things had existed before, like Albert Brooks had done some stuff with that, but that this was the first big one that it really worked. And Christopher Guest then went on to make three or four really good movies in that genre. Best in Show, Mighty
Waiting
Wind,
for
Waiting for Guffman, right? That was his first one. And a little bit, Thanks for Your Consideration, not as good as the other three, but it's still a good movie. And so he's good at it. My big question is this. Can Rob Reiner even direct a fucking movie anymore? Like, can Meathead really get... I'm going to ask you a serious question. What was the last movie you remember that Rob Reiner even directed? Because he had some hits, man. Few Good Men, that's him. Misery, that's him. Yeah. And then it's like... And this is Spinal Tap. Oh, The Princess Bride.
Yeah.
Four classics. Classics. And then he did, like, North with Elijah Wood and fell off the face of... Oh, how could I forget? When Harry Met Sally. Five classics. I feel like the count over here. But he then directed, like, I think North with Elijah Wood and then fell off the face of the earth. The last movie I think he's credited with, according to his IMDb page, is, because I had to look this up, is Shock and Awe, which is a movie about the invasion of Iraq that came out, because Rob Reiner is nothing if not timely, came out in 2017.
Well, you know, the thing about it is,
yep.
I got nothing.
He directed some porn movie called LBJ.
No.
With Woody Harrelson. No, it's LBJ with Woody Harrelson. But man, that's appropriate, isn't it? Woody as LBJ.
Oh. I mean, LBJ did call his cock Jumbo.
That's true. I'm just saying. But God. I forgot. He directed Stand By Me.
You said that funny.
Stand By Me. It's inconceivable.
It's inconceivable. I actually, the other week, I was at a music trivia thing that my sister invited me to because some people dropped out, and I am nothing if not full of useless information. And one of the songs that they played, like, you had to name the artist. Like, they play a clip and you had to name the artist, and it was Stand By Me, but it was a bait and switch because they wanted you to say Benny King, but it was not the Benny King version. It was the Otis Redding version.
The better version, let's just be honest. The Otis Redding version of any of his songs is the better version, except for Respect. That's the only one. But any other version of a song that was covered by somebody else is his only hit as Otis Redding was Dock of the Bay, right?
It was more of a break because Hard to Handle.
Yeah.
I did not realize the Black Crow song was his, and it's
so much better. Yeah. Yeah. It's a great song.
Like, aggressively better.
Mm-hmm. And it was also covered by the Small Faces too, which it was kind of the version that the Black Crows were doing, not the Otis Redding version, but whatever. We'll get into some of that. Like, hey, everything, everybody just been ripping off black artists forever and not giving them credit, except for there's a little bit of a twist to mine. Anyway, so yeah, here are the list of movies that Rob Reiner has directed. His first big one was This is Spinal Tap in 1984. Stand By Me, 1986. The Princess Bride, 1987. When Harry Met Sally, 1989. Misery, 1990. A Few Good Men, 1992. And then it goes downhill. Because then you got North. Then you got The American President. Then you got The Story of Us. And pretty much it. The last movie that he directed that I even recognize as, oh, yeah, I remember that movie. I don't think I watched it, but I remember it being out. The Bucket List. Jack Nicholson and Morgan Freeman. Yeah. So I love Rob Reiner. I mean, I think he's a sweet guy. I think he's a funny guy.
Bit of a meathead,
sure. A little bit too political for my taste sometimes, but that's fine. He was great in Wolf of Wall Street, but that's the last thing I remember him doing. It was like, what, Jonah Hill's dad in Wolf of Wall Street? I think that's what it was. Something like
that. He might have been.
Or Leo's dad? Yeah, Leo's dad, yeah. In The Wolf of Wall Street. I'm just saying, I don't trust it. I don't know. I want to like it, but I don't know.
I mean, I know Harry Shearer is still funny.
Yeah. Christopher Guest, I guess, is funny. I don't know.
Well, Jamie Lee's going to let him out of the house.
Yeah, Michael McKinney.
McKean,
thank you. I don't know. All right. Next story is this. Pearl Jam was playing a show at in Oakland, and they could have not gone on. They could have just said, hey, we can't do a show tonight, guys. You know how the world is right now. Because Matt Cameron, who is drumming for Pearl Jam, got COVID-19. And so they were like, what are we going to do? Well, their guitar player, and I guess he was in the Chili Peppers at one point, Josh Klinghoffer, who I've never heard of, but he's a, you know, like bands.
I think he was in one of those Frusciante list times.
Okay. The dark times. So this guy is touring with them as just kind of a backup, like extra to fill in sound guitar player. And he's like, oh, I know all your drum parts. I'll do it. And so they were like, well, let's practice. And they practice, and you're like, oh, yeah, that was fine. Okay, we can do this. And
not great, but, you know.
Not great, but, you know, it's not Matt
you're
Cameron.
You're not Matt Cameron.
Yeah, who the hell is. But, you know, that's fine. That's great. So he played most of the set. But there was a guy who came in and filled in on one last song, and it was Yellow Ledbetter. There was a guy named Richard Stuverard, and he apparently had won a contest to play Yellow Ledbetter with Pearl Jam. Pearl Jam asked fans to submit a video.
Not to be a dickhead, there are drums on Yellow Ledbetter.
They're there. Like, yeah, the we all know what Yellow Ledbetter sounds like, and the crux of it is the Hendrix Little Wing. Yeah, ripoff, which is honestly my favorite Pearl Jam song. And my favorite Pearl Jam song to play by far. But at the same time, it's a ripoff of Little Wing. Yeah, you're not asking him to do much, but it's still cool that this guy got up there and got to live out his dream playing with Pearl Jam.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome one of your own, Mr. Josh Arroyo.
Josh Arroyo. I'm sorry, I said the guy's... Hold on. Oh, okay. It's a little bit confusing. The fan was named Josh Arroyo. There were two drummers. They had Richard Stuverard and Klinghoffer took turns playing drums throughout the concert until the final song when Josh Arroyo, this is the fan, was brought on stage to perform Yellow Ledbetter. And they knew he could do it because they asked people to submit.
Okay, brother, you take the mask off.
Submit them playing songs to the band, and then they picked, let's go with the easiest one to play on drums. There you go. I always feel sorry whenever I see Pearl Jam playing live. I always feel sorry for people singing along to Yellow Ledbetter. Like, He changes the lyrics every time he plays. There's not going to be, you can't sing along with it.
I see Dems brown the runway.
Yeah. And so anyway, it's a nice moment, though. It reminds me of one of the greatest rock stories of all time, of course. The time that Keith Moon...
at the Cow Palace, just across the bay in San Francisco.
In San Francisco, somebody offered him, was it a monkey tranquilizer?
I believe it was. It was an animal tranquilizer.
It was an animal tranquilizer. And they said, okay, only take half. I have four of these, but only take half of one because otherwise you'll pass out. And Keith Moon went, I'm Keith Moon, and grabbed all of them and swallowed them. How he lived as long as he did. I know he died at like 36 or whatever, but how he even made it that far is insane.
Yeah.
Like, how he wasn't a member of the 27 Club is kind of crazy.
If you see the video, because there's video of that, and like he's
drumming,
Keith Moon, and yeah. and then it kind of slows down a little bit, and he's just out,
passes out. Yeah, it's like the tempo of the song starts like they're like, can't explain, think it's love, try to say you're out.
And then
he kept passing out, and they would like take him back and like throw water on him, and he'd wake up, get back out there, start playing, and then it's out. So then the Who goes, is there anybody out there who can play drums? Because this isn't before the show, this is during the show, so they can't just stop, there could be a riot. And so they ask anybody, can anybody come up and play? And some kid in the audience comes up and is like, I can kind of play. And so they put him on the kit. Sure enough, he's great. He's no Keith Moon, but he's great. And it's like the greatest story from a fan from any show ever. Like, not only did I get to see The Who, I got to play with The Who. Also reminds me of why Dave Grohl is like the greatest human being in rock and roll history, and that's because when the band Cage the Elephant was on tour opening for Foo Fighters, their drummer had a blood clot in his brain and had to go to the hospital, have an operation, and they were like, well, I guess that's us for the tour. We don't have a drummer. And Dave was like, yeah, you do. I'll do it. And they're like, Dave, no, Dave, we can't ask you to drum. You're Dave Grohl. He's like, Do you think you guys play songs that are more complicated than what I can do? Come on. I'm Dave Grohl. So, and he's like, I've been listening to your songs. You know, I got them. And I can't, he does actually, he talks about this in his autobiography, which I reference at least once an episode, that he really has only ever needed to hear a song once to know the drums on it. Like, that's just his particular genius, is things just
he's got a pornographic memory.
Yeah. And he so he played drums for Cage the Elephant. I don't think exclusively. I think some other people, like there were some fill-ins, like the same thing here.
A phonographic memory.
Phonographic. Pretty good.
Like,
pretty good.
Ah.
Yeah, I thought you said pornographic at first, but yes. So anyway, that's a nice story. Good on Pearl Jam. Still putting on the show. It always makes me think of like how many bands hate their audiences and look for any excuse to cancel a show, like Guns N' Roses. Like, yeah, what?
I was going to cough Guns N' Roses.
Oh, yeah, no, Guns N' Roses. Fuck Guns N' Roses. They are the worst. They are the absolute worst. Actually, it amazed me when Taylor Hawkins died. Drummer for Foo Fighters, RIP. He died, and I saw a thing from Axl Rose talking about how much he loved Foo Fighters and how heartbroken he was by all this. And I'm like, has Axl Rose changed? I mean, I guess it's been 30 years, but Jesus Christ, I did not expect that reaction from him.
I did. I don't know if it was a tweet or what, but it seemed strangely heartfelt.
Mm-hmm.
Unexpectedly.
I mean, maybe he has some regrets, but he also hated Nirvana and I would assume by extension, the Foo Fighters. This is a thing I love. I want to talk about. You know what the Eurovision Song Contest is?
Yes.
So for those of you who don't know, the Eurovision Song Contest is a big contest that they do in, of all places, Europe, every single year.
Crazy.
What?
Crazy.
Crazy. And every single country has like a contest within the country to see who they're going to submit to the contest. And usually it's some big bands. ABBA famously got their first break by winning the Eurovision Song Contest in like 1974, something like that. This year, the big band, not the winner, but they came in second place to the Ukrainian band because, you know, let's be honest, that's you're in Ukraine, you're running this year, you're going to win that. But an Italian band called Maneskin. And they were in competition for second place with a French band. And for whatever reason, Emmanuel Macron, who is the president of France, did everything he could to get Maneskin, the Italian band, kicked off of the ballot. I just want to say, like, when you think our politics are petty, can you imagine imagine Donald Trump calling? Okay, you can't imagine this, but I couldn't. It would still be a little bit of a stretch. Him watching something like this that has nothing to do with him, I guess. But like watching American Idol and like calling and be like, no, that Justin Guarini kid, he needs to win. I don't want that Kelly Clarkson. Get that bitch off the stage. You know, I just can't imagine an American president getting that wrapped up in something like this.
Unless it was Kanye.
Yeah, that's true. If he was president, obviously. But his reasoning was because the band was doing drugs on stage. They weren't like doing drugs on stage. Like apparently like the lead singer like knelt down and it looked like he may have done a bump of cocaine, but there was no proof of it. And he was just kind of acting like, I don't know. So,
I'm told there are cocaine orgies in Washington, D.C., so I don't see any problem.
What is the... We played a Maneskin song one time.
We did. Here. We did, and it was okay.
Yeah, I think it's this. Hold on. I'm going to be your slave.
I want to be a slave, yeah, this is. I want to be a master. I want to make your heartbeat run like roller coaster.
I like the guy's voice. It's got a very Britpop feel to it for an Italian band.
I wouldn't have thought they were, because...
Yeah, they're Italian.
Yeah, I wouldn't have thought they were Italian.
Yeah, they kind of sound like a dirtier version of... There's a really good Britpop band from the... I think they're still around, but from last... last decade. I mean, 2 decades ago now. Called the Kooks. Have you ever heard of the Kooks?
Yeah.
A little bit like that. A little bit like the Wombats. I like them. Anyway, so yeah, he tried to get him kicked off, and I don't know. Didn't work out. And finally, last thing in music news is, I don't know if you care about this. I know I don't. I'm not the biggest fan of this band in general. But Michael Anthony has said that he's been in talks to reunite with Van Halen. Now... Here's the
thing. I was a little disappointed. I did see Van Halen live. Yeah. They got back with DLR.
Yep.
And like, it wasn't a thing that I was like super jazzed. I got to go see Van Halen, but like, it was a Saturday when I was still tending bar and I was working the day shift, mm-hmm. and somehow it came up that Van Halen was playing, and I was like, oh, I would probably go see that. Like, I would go and see if I could get a ticket.
Yeah.
And I did. And I bought a ticket from a scalper who tried to sell me a ticket for face value, like, an hour after the concert started. I don't think I missed any Van Halen. I missed the opening act. But he was trying to sell me the ticket for face value, and I'm like, no.
Van Halen is just one of those bands that I'm not dismissive of people who like Van Halen. I certainly think there's some musical integrity there. I don't know. It's a little too cock rocky for me. Or it might also be like the fault might also be that growing up when we did and getting into music in the early and mid 90s, so many of the bands that were that we were into were like a rejection of bands, right, like Van Halen, the Spandex and High Jumps and stuff like that. I mean, you know, Panama's a great song. Not going to dismiss that Eddie Van Halen was an amazing songwriter and guitar player, but I couldn't ever get into them. Having said that, Michael Anthony, who cares?
The baseline for Beautiful Girls is very sound.
Is anybody going to a Van Halen show and going, I fucking thought Michael Anthony was going to be here. Well, if he's not here, then why am I even here? You? Are you that person?
I mean, I would have preferred it was Michael Anthony as compared to Wolfgang. But
why? What difference does it make? It's Van. The bass lines aren't that integral to Van Halen.
Listen to Beautiful Girls and tell me otherwise.
One song. You can name one song.
Yeah.
Okay.
Running with the Devil is one of the hardest one-note bass.
Boom, 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 boom. It's boom, boom, boom.
It is literally one note.
Boom, boom.
There is a point where he goes, boom, though.
Oh, like right. He does do that.
He does like a, yeah. So that, huh?
All right. We're done. All right, now we're going to do a little thing called riff and...
Okay,
you had something. So, yeah, go ahead.
Well, is there a point to going and seeing a Van Halen concert
without Eddie?
Dead Eddie Van Halen?
Yeah, I wouldn't... even if you have DLR, I couldn't care less. I mean, I wouldn't go anyway, even if they had the original lineup, but I certainly wouldn't go if Eddie's not there. Like, who are you going to get to even replace him? That's, like, one of the most irreplaceable people in rock and roll history. Like, him and, like... Hendrix and Keith Moon. Like, we saw The Who without Moon. It was fine. It was okay. I mean, I'm glad we saw him, but it was more like, oh, we're going to see Daltrey and Pete Townsend, not The Who.
Right.
You know.
They have utterly capable musicians playing with them.
Backing up. And they were good. They were good. Just not
But
the
they
same.
Don't have John Entwistle and Keith Moon.
Yeah, I forgot. They also didn't have... Yeah, we thought we were getting Entwistle.
Yeah, when we bought the tickets.
Yeah. He died. Let me tell you about my good buddy Cody Akins at AkinsPCRepair.com. He makes computers there. I actually am using a computer that he made there at AkinsPCRepair.com. He put it together for me. It is the best computer I've ever owned, bar none. He sells computers that he's also refurbished and fixed up. And he also fixes phones and tablets and everything. It says Akins PC Repair, but he fixes anything that has a screen. Also, if you're somebody who needs backup, you're worried about all of the work on your computer. Maybe you're doing a lot of work at home. A lot of people are these days. And you're worried about losing all that stuff. Well, guess what? You need to have a data backup. Cody Akins sells that. I think $15 a month is what it costs. For the peace of mind of knowing that you're never going to lose your important data, that seems like a steal. So make my computer guy your computer guy. Go to Cody Akins at AkinsPCRepair.com. All right, so now it's time to do a little bit, I'm calling riff ancestry, or as James called it, riffistry. I've always been interested in this because, I mean, James and I were in a band together. We wrote songs, and sometimes we'd come up with a song, or I would come up with a song, and James would look at me and go, "That's Everlong. What are you doing?" And you know, you do that. You think like you have this beautiful, amazing thing, and then somebody points out, "No, that's Here Comes the Sun." So that just happens. Stuff happens all the time. And some bands, when that happens, they're too insecure to just plow ahead. And go, I don't care if it sounds like something else. I got chops and I'm going to make this work. And other bands go, I'm terrified of being called a fraud when I got on stage. So everything has to be original and not sound like anything else. Nirvana was not one of those latter-day bands. They were a band that wrote a song. They claimed that was specifically ripping off several songs at once. It was ripping off a Pixie song and a song called Smells Like... A song called More Than a Feeling. Obviously, the song, as I've already alluded to, was Smells Like Teen Spirit. That's what Kurt said.
If they were ripping off a song called Smells Like Teen Spirit, that would be a little on the nose.
That would be a little bit too blatant. Now, if you don't know the Pixies ripoff, so I'm going to get into that first. They ripped off a song by the Pixies, again, on purpose. So I don't know if it... Does it count against you if you're open about it?
No,
I
like
don't.
If it's like it's you're making it a very overt
homage.
Influence.
So the song by the Pixies that they're ripping off is called Gigantic. It's Kim Deal on vocals. It's off of the album Doolittle, and it's a great song. Here's the, it's not the entire song. It's just the pre-chorus. It's, here.
Actually, off Surfer Rosa, John.
Is it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're right. Is it? Oh, you know what? This YouTube thing is wrong, and it has Doolittle. I know it's off of Surfer. I knew that. I knew it was off of Surfer Rosa. You don't need to tell me. So that's hello, 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 that. And then, of course, the major ripoff is the main verse, which in Smells Like Teen Spirit, or not main verse, but the main chorus riff, which in Smells Like Teen Spirit is. And in More Than a Feeling is. I don't think that they're so similar that it's a ripoff. It's not like, what was that, Sam, what was that guy's name that ripped off Won't Back Down? Stay With Me.
Sam Smith.
Sam Smith. Yeah, how could I forget a name like such a unique name like Sam Smith? But yeah, Stay With Me was obviously the melodic ripoff of Won't Back Down. This is just more of ripping off the fact that you're using power chords. It's ripping off a concept more than anything. So conceptually,
it's got that kind of it's power stuttery, chords. Chugging.
Yes, it's power chords, and then the palm muting and strokes on the downstrokes, and you know that's just how it is. It's a bit of an homage or ripoff, however you want to say it. So you can see how they sound the same. Well, I went into it and I was like, I want to know where this comes from. Because if Kurt was willing to admit that he was ripping off More Than a Feeling, then was More Than a Feeling a ripoff of something? Or was it at least inspired? So I started digging around. Tom Scholz, who wrote More Than a Feeling and most of Boston songs, he did not say. He would not admit to any ripoff, any homage. In fact, he doesn't like to talk too much about his songwriting process. So I didn't know where to go with this other than I knew that there's no way this was like just, oh, I came up with this and no one else has ever played anything like this ever before ever. That just doesn't happen. So I looked into what some reviewers had said about More Than a Feeling. And a lot of people pointed to a different song as far as that riff is concerned as an inspiration for More Than a Feeling, and they said it was obvious if not a ripoff, and that song is this. A little bit slower on Wild Thing, but definitely there's the din 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 din. So I did find an interview with the Trogs where they admitted that that was a ripoff of another song. They said that that was a ripoff of what I consider a proto-punk song that they did a cover of, a song called Louie Louie. You ever heard of it? And in fact, they love that song, Louie Louie, so much that they wrote Wild Thing. And also, at the same time, in the same recording session that they recorded Wild Thing, they did this. Louie Louie, oh baby, me gotta go. All right. So you might think that that's where it ends. Louie Louie by the Kingsmen. That's such a proto-rock song. Came out in 1962 or 63.
Motorhead covered it.
Motorhead covered it. it was an inspiration for the Kinks to do All Day and All Night a year later. And man, if you listen, by the way, just off note, if you go back and listen to All Day and All Night, the distortion on that guitar is so good for that time. Like, that's 1964, and it sounds like straight up off of a punk album from 1977. I'm not going to go into how they got that sound. I do know, but it's crazy the things that they had to do to just get that. Like, nowadays it's just a pedal, but back then it involved like razors and shit. So that's not the end of it, though, because you might not know that Louie Louie by the Kingsmen is a cover. Originally, the song was by Chuck Berry's cousin Marvin. No, it's by Richard Berry. Richard Berry. It's not by Marvin Berry. It's by a guy named Richard Berry, who is in no relation to Chuck Berry's, as far as I know. But here's that song. Came out in 1955, Louie Louie by Richard Berry. So I wasn't satisfied with that, because I was kind of on a heater here. And have you ever done Ancestry.com? If anybody out there ever has, you know you're not satisfied with finding your great-grandfather. You need to figure out, like, where in, you know, Holland were there other people with the same name, last name as you? And what would my life have been like if I'd have been born back then, and that kind of shit? So I kept digging.
You've been a tulip magnate.
Yeah. And I read some, believe it or not, there's some interviews with Richard Berry talking about his inspiration for Louie Louie. This was years later, when Louie Louie is one of the most covered songs of all time. And he said, "Oh yeah, I'm surprised I haven't been sued. That is a ripoff of a song by Rene Touzetz. It's called El Loco Cha Cha." So here's that song. Just sounds like Louie Louie. So, going backwards, working backwards, you go from this to this to this. It's somewhere in that Trogs version as well. And the Trogs do it a little better, I think. To me, honestly, I just listened to the Trogs version for the first time. I kind of like their version of Louie Louie more than the Kingsmen. That's just me. But in somewhere in between the Trogs and the Kingsmen, you get an extra note. That's the dun dun dun. That part is where the riff starts to change. It goes from dun 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 dun. They add that dun 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 dun. Dun, 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 dun. And then eventually you get, and then, so yeah, Smells Like Teen Spirit, it was a conga song.
Nice.
All right, it's time to do a little segment called What If, where we're going to give out what if scenarios and just discuss how likely they are to have happened in rock history. James, I'll let you start with yours. I've been commanding way too much time here. James, what's your what if scenario?
My what if scenario goes a bit. So on May 16th of 1966, Jeff Beck, as I said, was taking a break from the Yardbirds. He had taken over lead guitar work after Eric Clapton had left to form Cream with Jack Bruce and Ginger Baker. He gathered a group of musicians for a one-off recording of a song called Beck's Bolero that he had been tooling around with Jimmy Page. That was a 12-string guitar riff that was based rhythmic. When the musicians thought out were Jimmy Page to play guitar. Mm-hmm. And he approached Keith Moon to play drums. He was, you know, most everybody's favorite drummer, because he was just so out there and good and just hit so hard. Was a very dynamic and original drummer. He got Nicky Hopkins to play piano. When he approached Moon about playing, he's like, yeah, sure. He's like, you should get John Entwistle to play bass. And it was not a great time for The Who. This is actually between the time when they had recorded The Who Sings My Generation and before they had done a quick one.
What song was on The Who Sings My Generation? What was their big song over that?
Can't Explain.
Oh, all right. Of course.
Yeah.
So that wasn't a great time for The Who. Why? I mean, they were always kind of contentious. They're always a lot of fighting within The Who, was it?
So it was...
Pete's a bit of an egomaniac and control freak, and you're dealing with Keith Moon, who kind of a wild bucking bronco there.
A little bit. So Entwistle and Moon particularly were not terribly happy with the way the band was headed. Moon was really paranoid that Pete and God, what was the guy's name? Their manager.
Roger,
I can't
Dalton.
Think of his name.
Oh, yeah, I don't know.
We're gonna find out and be really, really mad.
Mm-hmm.
So he showed up in costume, like he had like a Cossack cap, like a fur.
Yeah, nobody's
Russian
gonna
hat.
Notice you. That's such a Keith Moon thing. So inconspicuous, there, Keith.
And sunglasses, like, oh no, that's certainly not Keith Moon. So he showed up. Entwistle did not. So, there's speculation that he felt like he was a bit more beholden to Pete, like they had been,
yeah,
school friends, and so he's like, yeah, no, I don't want to. So he didn't show up to this recording session. So what wound up happening was, they got a session guy to come in, a guy named John Paul Jones. So in this situation, you have Jimmy Page, you have John Paul Jones, you have the crux of a half of what became Led Zeppelin.
Right.
Moon did play on it. It's an interesting song. But I'm a little curious. My what-if scenario is, what if John Entwistle had shown up that day? And here are my two possible scenarios there, and you can tell me which one you think is more likely to have happened.
Mm-hmm.
Entwistle and Moon, already having excellent chemistry, find the experience of recording with Beck and Page to be an enjoyable respite from Pete Townsend's increasingly controlling manner. So they decide to leave The Who and see what they can do with these new guys. Okay, so this is 66, prior to the recording of The Who's sophomore effort, A Quick One. Pete Townsend and Roger Daltrey, despite their often contentious relationship, continue to work together with alternate musicians on bass and drums.
Right.
Without the contribution of Moon and Entwistle, albums such as A Quick One, The Who Sell Out, Tommy, and Who's Next are not going to be the same. They're right. Just, I mean, they are, and we have discussed this on programs before, Pete Townsend, fantastic songwriter, incredible musician, wrote very intricate demos at home that were the rough outlines that, for example, Keith Richards has said, well, they're better than The Who, so
yeah,
they're
Keith
not.
Richards is not a trusty narrower. Keith Richards saying that is like when Tom Brady says he talks up other quarterbacks to... because he just is full of shit. Like he likes to give them a sense of overconfidence so that, you know, he can beat them easier.
Yeah. So, all right. So that obviously your Who albums are not going to be the same.
Right.
Well,
who's singing though? If Moon and Entwistle leave The Who, then, because I think The Who, without Entwistle and Moon, is obviously not as good, but I think for most people, so long as the songwriting and the singer are the same, that then a lot of people are still going to be okay with it. But who's singing on Beck's Bolero?
There's no words.
Okay, hold on. I have this. Let me pull it up. And you know, it's going to start playing. But okay.
Thank you.
It's interesting for 1967, especially. Okay. So that's the scenario that they leave. They inform Led Zeppelin.
The New Yardbirds.
The New Yardbirds, which is basically Led Zeppelin without John Paul Jones or Bonham. Okay.
Or
Plant. They would need a singer, though. Like, that's just not going to work without a singer. So
Jeff Beck can sing. He doesn't sing a ton, but
he's not. I don't know. He's good. I'm not. But Jeff Beck's mostly known as a guitar player. He's not known as a great singer, which I think you would need. You'd need like a good front man, like Robert Plant or Daltrey or something.
Okay. So in my scenario here, New Yardbirds, Beck, Page, Moon, and Entwistle solidify into a working unit. Entwistle, previously a good songwriter in a band with a great songwriter, takes more onus to write and sing songs.
Okay.
Beck and Page managed to form a working collaborative songwriter partnership. Record several albums to relentlessly twin lead guitar attack, complemented by the explosive rhythm section, astounds audiences and fellow musicians alike. I really feel like they'd be
band. Yes, a musician's band. Yes, very much.
John Paul Jones continues a successful studio career. Robert Plant peddles his J.R.R. Tolkien songs in another band, but Led Zeppelin's never formed, and The Who are never quite the same. Moon and Entwistle both die of substance-related deaths decades apart in a similar fashion to how it happened in the real world, because I just feel like that's
going to happen. Yeah.
So that's scenario one.
Okay.
Okay. So now scenario two is a little bit of a tweak on it. So recording goes ahead as before with Entwistle and Moon. They have a good time, decide to leave Pete and Roger for this new opportunity. Beck and Page's relationship becomes increasingly fraught after two albums and the group implodes.
Okay.
Moon and Entwistle, not wanting to pick a side between either Beck or Page, go back to Pete and say, hey, you know, you want to get back together. But Pete has sunken into substance abuse following his rhythm section's betrayal and declines. Goes on to do solo records much earlier after alienating Roger Daltrey.
Yeah.
Page goes on to collaborate with Plant, Bonham, and Jones. The Led Zeppelin name is a casualty without the contribution of Entwistle and Moon.
Right, because that's where they got the name from, yeah.
Following the dissolution of Cream, Moon and Entwistle join up with Eric Clapton and Steve Winwood for a short-lived team-up, so this is kind of a tweak on Blind Faith.
Mm-hmm.
After going their separate ways, Pete Townsend eventually sobers up, realizes he's unhappy without a robust group of musicians willing to challenge him creatively, so he extends an olive branch to all of the former members of The Who in the mid-70s. They reform the original classic Who lineup, put out a number of critically and commercially successful albums before amicably parting ways in the early 80s. Moon and Entwistle, never having maintained the same sustained success, managed to temper their particular substance problems, and they still perform to this day on periodical Who reunion tours.
Okay, so of those two scenarios, and maybe it's just the
opposite. Which one do you think?
I think scenario number two is much more likely. And the reason why is because having listened to Beck's Bolero, it wasn't that good. And I don't think that that would be enough for them to go, let's leave this band that's already successful for the Yardbirds, who, I mean, the Yardbirds were okay. I mean, they did well, but they weren't like smash hit. They were a very much a musician's band. Where, you know, they were the band that inspired other bands more than they were just themselves all that popular. So I think scenario two is more likely from that perspective. Also, I think that we're overestimating how Pete would have reacted to the situation in the first scenario, where I think in the second, I think it's more likely that he would try to mend fences, because he was an egomaniac, and he was, I mean, he could be and still can be very narcissistic and everything, but he's also not an idiot. And he knew that John and Keith were perfect for what he wanted to do and perfect for the sound that he wanted. So I think it might've taken him a while, but he definitely would have tried to patch things up.
I do think that situation where, like, shortly thereafter, if he were approached by him, be like, "Hey, let's get the band back," he'd be like, "Fuck you guys."
Yes. Yeah. Exactly.
You betrayed me.
Yeah, you betrayed me.
But I think with time as a healer of wounds, he'd have been like, "You know what? Like,
what we had was good. Let's try it again."
And for better or worse, is like, yeah, I write good songs, but what they bring to the table challenges me.
Right. And plus, I read an interview with him where he said that he, from very early on, genuinely loved Keith and John and Roger. Really, like, he said that's the problem with being in a band with people that you love is you're going to fight more because you feel betrayed when they disagree with you. You're like, but I thought you loved me too. What the fuck is this? But he was like, so many bands are successful because it's a business relationship and they don't feel like brothers. But those guys are my brothers, so we fight a lot more, and sometimes it can get even more heated. All right, cool. So, yeah.
But when they get back together and make out, it's all the hotter.
Brothers are supposed to hug. all right, I have my what-if scenario, and then we're going to end on this. And my what-if scenario is this. If Japan had never invaded China, John Lennon might still be alive.
Huh?
Okay.
Huh?
So here's...
How's that for a BuzzFeed clickbait?
Here's the story. As we know, in 1939, Japan invaded China. It was a brutal invasion where even like Nazis who were there in Nanking, there's actually a movie about it with Steve Buscemi, Nazis who were there saw what the Japanese were doing and sheltered Chinese citizens from the Japanese. Sheltered them because they were like, this is so horrifying and bad. So there's literally a movie out there somewhere. I need to find it. With Steve Buscemi basically playing the Nazi version of Oscar Schindler. The rape of Nanking in particular was insane, and I don't even have the stomach to go into how bad that was. It was so bad that the United States, who, pretty racist country to this day in a lot of ways, unfortunately, but especially back then, looked at it and went, that is so goddamned awful. We're going to impose sanctions on Japan for what they've done. Because that was so horrifying. So they impose harsh sanctions on Japan. In retaliation for that, of course, Japan bombs Pearl Harbor in 1941, which started the Pacific Theater of War, led to the U.S. firebombing Tokyo. A lot of people forget about that period of the war. But during World War II, Hiroshima and Nagasaki get all the big headlines. But the lead that is buried is the absolutely terrifying firebombing of Tokyo that happened that was actually worse than Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
We weren't too bashful about incendiary bombs.
Yeah.
If you've read Slaughterhouse-5.
Yes, right. It's pretty bad, right. We went Dresden on Tokyo. And there was a wealthy aristocrat who lived in Tokyo by the name of Isuke. And he decided to move his family, ironically, to the United States. This was actually right after the war. They fled Japan, and then right after the war, moved to the United States, and because they had some family there. And soon after that, his daughter joined them. This is in the early 1950s. And she went to a Bohemian college. She pursued art and music and eventually got a showing in London, where she met John Lennon, who she claimed she had no idea who he even was, and that made her incredibly charming to him. Obviously, you know who this person is. It's Yoko Ono. The rest is history. John meets Yoko.
Oh, no.
They fall in love, or whatever it was. He leaves his wife for Yoko, and they get married, and then... Annoy the shit out of everybody. In December of 1980, he's outside of the Dakota in New York City, and he gets shot by Mark David Chapman. So here are the scenarios I'm going to present. Number one, say Japan, and I don't want to get into how different the world would have been otherwise if Japan had never invaded China, but say Japan had never invaded China, and that would have meant that the United States and Japan had not gone to war, which meant Yoko wouldn't have gone to America, so John and Yoko would have never met. She would have stayed in Japan. Scenario one, John has spent years doing drugs and daydreaming and ignoring his family. He decides that he's been too obsessed with writing songs and being a Beatle. He tells Cynthia, his wife, that he's going to quit the Beatles and focus on his family. He does this, and their last album of the 60s is Sgt. Pepper's. After a few years away, John, now fully refreshed and with Cynthia's support, rejoins the band. They start touring again. They record 8 new albums in the 70s, all of which are better than the next. They split ways to pursue solo projects, but reform every year at a giant festival called Beatlemania, where their favorite hand-picked bands play, and obviously the Beatles are the closers. This sheds light on new and exciting bands that no one else has ever heard of before. John and Paul mourn the passing of George in 2001, and Ringo, who dies in 2014 when he boards Malaysian Flight 370, never to be seen again. John and Paul still play together once a year at Beatlemania and record new stuff. In 2020, on his 80th birthday, John has a stroke and is rushed to the hospital. On the way there, his son Julian hears his last words. His last words being, "Hey Jude, don't let me down." Julian has no idea what that means because the song, obviously, Hey Jude, had never been written. He and Paul decide, based on John's last words, to write that song together as a tribute to John at his funeral, which is watched by millions, and Hey Jude becomes what's known as the last Beatles song, and it is their biggest set ever. So that's scenario one, if John had never met Yoko. Scenario number two, John never stops doing drugs, ends up overdosing and dying in a hotel in 1978 while hanging out with Sid Vicious and Nancy Spungen. Those are your two options.
I mean, I like the first one better.
Look, if Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness has taught me anything, there is a universe where that happens. All of these things. Right. So you can say, that would have never happened. No, no, no. In an infinite number of new universes, any of these could have happened. So you want scenario one, but you think scenario two is more likely.
Yeah. Again, I don't know if it's still out, available. You really need to see Everything Everywhere All at Once.
I know. Actually, it is, and I keep telling myself I'm going to see it. But now with streaming, I'm like, so like if I miss a movie, I'll wait a month and it'll be out on streaming, so I'll watch it then.
I feel like you would benefit from seeing it in theaters.
Theater? Okay.
It's Strangers.
I'll try. Okay. Anyway, so which one? Which one, James? Scenario one or two?
No, John's going to OD. He's gonna just sink into that and just be a dick.
He was down a dark path before he met Yoko. If anything, Yoko probably did save him for a little bit because he needed somebody to, you know, take control of his life, and no one else is willing to do it.
Yeah, and for all of Cynthia, like, she knew him before he was John Lennon of the Beatles. Like, he was just John. But the power dynamic of that relationship was set. Like, that wasn't going to change. He was going to be abusive when he wanted to be abusive. He was going to cheat when he wanted to cheat. Like,
the Addams Family.
He doesn't. He beats when he wants to beat, cheats when he wants to cheat.
They keep it in step, the Addams Family. All right.
I don't think that self-awareness was going to come to him anytime soon.
Right. All right.
Not saying it couldn't have happened eventually.
Yeah.
But I think the heroin would have won before self-awareness did.
I agree. And there you go. I unfortunately do agree. That's why I made the first scenario so rosy and sunny to beggar belief. But, you know, there are probably more universes where the scenario two happens. But I'd like to believe that there's a universe where scenario one happens.
And you know, because John had a stroke, he couldn't say Julian. So he said, dude,
that's what I, doesn't it make more sense? Yeah. All right. That's the show. Thanks, guys. Bye.
Take this, bitch.